All right.
Hi, this is Paul, and this is an experiment, and we're having a four-way conversation today. And well, whose bright idea was this?
Well, this was my time technically.
Yes.
And Luke and I Luke reached out to me after my first conversation with you, Paul, via you. And he and I have been talking back and forth ever since then. And in the comments of our conversation, Job reached out and said, "Hey, I'm going to be in Texas. You know, let's meet up. Texas, you know, if you're in Texas, we can meet. It's really close."
Very small.
So Job and I met up in Austin. I drove down to him and we had lunch and we had some good conversation. So it was really neat and really strange to get to meet in person, but it was good. Not a bad kind of strange. And so then when Luke and I were talking, he had mentioned that he wanted to have another conversation with you, Paul. And I got to the point where I decided I wanted to talk to you again. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to find a slot. Well, I eventually found one and I sent a screenshot of my booked talk with you to Luke. And he's like, "What? How did you get a slot?" And I said, "Well, hey, there's a slot on the same day, like 1 hour before my session. You know, if it's still there, go grab it if you want it." So he did. And then in short order, I just happened to be talking to Job a little bit. And I mentioned, "Hey, you know, Luke and I are going to be talking to Paul on the same day." And Job said, "You guys should just book the same time together." And I know that Luke needed to talk to you just to get some ideas out. And I'm very interested to see how that conversation went. Just, you know, spoiler for everybody, that conversation happened before this one. And so I said back to Job, I said, "Hey, you're welcome to join me if you want to." And I can't remember who said it, but, you know, we should reach out to Luke too and just have him stay over. So that's kind of the genesis of all this. So it was, okay. I think technically it was Job's bright idea.
Oh, yeah. I just figured the three of us should colonize this channel. And
all right. So here we are. Who's got the first thing to say that gets us going? Well, Jeff, maybe a little round of introductions, because probably not everybody watched all the videos. So, Jeff, you first, just real quick.
I am in Texas. I was raised in church. You and I talked for a long time about several different things. I'm a big C.S. Lewis fan. I read George MacDonald. That's a connection that Luke and I have. I don't want to steal his thunder, so I'll pass the ball.
Okay. How about you?
Okay, so I've talked with Paul now. Today was our third time. The first one was unaired, all the vulgarity and things. No, I'm just kidding. I think I grew up in the church also, and I've just been on a slow progression. I'm the guy that always talks about orthodoxy and how fruitful that's been for me. So I moved that way just the last few years, kind of through this whole phenomenon and you and Jonathan Peugeot, and I'd been going that way for a long time, and I live in Minneapolis.
Okay. Job, you've had more space on my channel than almost anybody, I think.
I think this is the fourth.
Yeah, that's right. So Nick's been on more. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, I'm Job. I'm from the Netherlands. I try not to be religious, but hey. No, I can't help but joke, so I don't have to be serious about it. I'm not a believer. Luke disagrees.
Well, that was a complicated discussion. I just said we're going to have some fellowship. Today,
it's interesting.
Evangelical code words there, Luke.
That's right. Yeah. Koinonia. I'll just stick with the Greek.
Considering myself, I don't know, recovering atheist, I think works really well. I like the whole Christian agnostic, but I have been reading about Pelagius, and I like what he has to say. So, yeah.
Interesting.
So, Paul, who are you?
Pelagian. I'm me. It's my channel. People who found this video already kind of know who I am, so I don't have to introduce myself.
Oh, hey, Paul, there was one other thing that I wanted to share. Whenever I was talking to my wife about us, you know, pulling this whole thing together, I said, yeah, you know, it's kind of like Paul's building his own Marvel Cinematic Universe. All of these one-on-one conversations are the standalone movies, and you know, this is the first team up of all of his online guests.
Okay. Dave,
this is
I
a quick
Nick Cage.
No, if I could share this. So this is a quick thing we didn't get to in my talk, Paul, but I mentioned to you an email, Gabriel Marsal. Who's this? I love him. I've started reading him, but his general ideas I love. But I had an idea for a t-shirt that I wanted to make that was Marcel greater than Marvel. And it was just going to be my little inside joke.
Oh, okay. So
when you brought up Marvel, I just had to throw that in.
Okay. So what's on your mind, gentlemen? What's new? What do you want to talk about? You want to talk about Jordan Peterson stuff? Did anybody else listen to the conversation with Bishop Barron?
I haven't heard that yet.
Yeah, it's hard to listen to.
Really?
Yeah, because Peterson just sounds like he's unraveling.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like you feel, you can hear the pain and the stress and the stuff that's going on with Tammy.
Yeah.
And it's a good conversation, but it's certainly one I have to listen to again so I can kind of try to distract my mind from engaging too much emotionally. Mm. Let's see. Jeff, what I liked is when I asked you what we should talk about, you said, hey, how about this kind of weird thing of internet randos coming together on some Calvinist pastor's YouTube channel? And I think that is an interesting thing to discuss. I mean, how these things happen. And I mean, it's got to be totally surreal for Paul to begin with. But like, okay, you know, you guys have been talking, you and Luke have been talking, we had some barbecue, now I've been talking to Luke, and it's just, this seems to go very naturally. Like, Paul will have someone on, some of us will think that person has something to say, and then it goes from there. And I don't really know if it's a subject that, I don't know. It's just, I like the idea. I don't know if it'll turn into an actual discussion point, but I think
so,
it's interesting.
If I may, I think this would be my thought and hypothesis on it. And I think it's inherent to the larger Jordan Peterson phenomenon, the ID intellectual dark web, long form conversations, podcasts, all of that. I think that greater phenomenon is, I think it's indicative of a deep hunger that people have for real connection and conversation with people that I don't think was being met. And I think that, like, for all of us, like even my conversation with you yesterday, Job, and every interaction I've had with Jeff is, I don't know where you stand on a host of issues, and I don't care, honestly. I mean, I do care, but I think one of the things that I love so much about Paul's channel is it's a niche of the larger Jordan Peterson phenomenon that's specifically about Christianity and religion, or more so. But I think it's just filled with a bunch of people from myriad backgrounds, but it's honest seekers, it's honest searchers, it's people that aren't afraid to some degree to say what they think. It's non-ideological. Mm. And that's what I've found to be most refreshing, and that's what I find to be honest. That's what I found to be most honest in talking to you yesterday. I mean, you're an earnest person, and I'm immediately drawn to that. I mean, we talked about that with Jordan Peterson. It's admiration.
Mm.
Which was Eric's big point in my conversation with him.
It's a hallmark of a good community. I mean, I'm a member of a couple of programmer communities, and once in a while we have a conference. And a good community is where you don't just talk about whatever this language does, but stuff around it as well. Mm. And then you're free to disagree with each other. And I think that's the same for this and how we see this sort of stuff branch out in the intellectual dark web. I mean, it's difficult, you know, because you hear people say, "Oh, we just want to learn from each other, and we don't care if we hold different views." And that's easy to say, you know. But I mean, I'm just going on a tangent here. But
is there a Jordan Peterson community?
Oh, geez.
You know, so my conversation with Dr. Jim Field, and that I've had two conversations with him, but the first one, you know, he basically, I thought, laid out one of the most plausible narratives about why Jordan Peterson took hold, in that basically the way he said something crystallized a whole disparate group of people who were sort of on the outside and gave them a rallying cry, and or at least gave them a something together around him. But so then you have atheists who feel a little bit dispossessed by the social justice warrior, the identity politics stuff. You have Christians who are feeling dispossessed for a variety of reasons, and here this guy says appreciative things about the Bible, you know. And even the group of us, you know, Luke is exploring orthodoxy. Jeff loves Lewis. And is that a cat, Jeff, or a dog?
We have to have another cat.
Here you have to have another cat. There we go. Every video is made better by a cat or a dog. And so, you know, so obviously just a select group of people who were listening to Jordan Peterson stuck on my channel. There's probably been 5 or 6 times as many people who listened to a minute or two of me talking and, you know, clicked on to someplace else, but you all stuck. So the question that Jordan Peterson has is very much a question that I have, you know, what's going on? And I don't even know I wonder that in terms of, maybe you should start there. Why do you all continue to listen to this channel? So I had one of my friends the other day say, "I don't listen to most of the conversations, they're boring." And I thought, wow, that's probably true. Some of the conversations are boring. I just wait for your videos. And it's like, oh, okay. But there's a whole bunch of people who do listen to all the conversations and remember them. So, all right. So what is that?
Well, I'm one of those people. Like, I was happy to see, you know, today Cassidy showed up again. So I just, you know, I watched Cassidy's video and I even left the comment, and I just stick around. You know, we're doing other things while we're listening. Usually, you know, we're not just sitting here staring at the screen with our eyes glued to it. At least I'm not, you know, I'm doing stuff around the house, or I'm, you know, doing stuff at work while I can listen at the same time. And whatever catches my attention and like breaks me out of what I'm doing, you know, there's that salience, you know, like Rebecca talks about, and Luke had mentioned that whenever he had talked about, you know, what he got out of watching my conversation with you. Yeah. And so I come back for things that just, you know, pop out at me, or things that stand out and get me thinking in new ways, or opening up new vistas for me. So that's why I keep coming back.
Okay.
So I think I agree. I think it's, I don't know, and Paul, maybe you, I think what you're asking is like, why are these things salient to all these people? What's the common reason why? Because I do. I mean, I've stopped watching a lot of things and listening to podcasts, but I watch almost all of your videos, even your conversations. I probably watch 95% or more. And I think for me, it really is, it's honest inquiry. And I haven't gotten far into it, but Gabriel Marcel, I'll bring him up again. He has one of his big words and phrases and ideas that he talks about is his idea of searching. and it's people who are honest seekers who, the way I've always said it is, people who are committed to the truth outside of the truth that they currently apprehend. And I think your channel is full of those people. And I think that Jordan Peterson largely is full of those people. I mean, granted, he's gotten a big enough following now that I'm sure there's a lot of sycophants that are just following it to be tribal and to be on the bandwagon and who aren't honestly searching. But that's always been my biggest thing of Jordan Peterson. I mean, frankly, that's why I love the fact he won't answer the resurrection question. I mean, I love that about him. I'm just like, good. Thank you. Don't answer it. Wonderful. You can't answer it authentically. Don't. And I love him the more. I mean, people get mad at him, but that's just because they want him on their team. And that's gross.
Gross even. Wow.
I do find it to be gross. I find it to be a form of deception. Mm-hmm. It's lying. And I don't think it's pleasing to God to just want people on your team just because that's the ultimate thing, just because they're on your team. You want people on your team inauthentically?
Well, your team thing becomes an ego thing.
Yeah.
We want people on my team. We want people, I mean, it's sour. We want people to reflect me. I mean, yes. And that is deeply troubling, and that's demonic. You can't love and want that. Those two things are contradictory.
Yeah. It's otherness. I mean, it's Trinitarian, ultimately. There's otherness, but unity and love. I mean, it's not everything being the same without, ultimately, it would destroy love. It's just stark, white, blank nothingness. You know, without contrast. You know, I mean, you need difference in order to have genuine relationship and love, I think. Sorry, I'll try not to just make this go into like a deep philosophical tirade.
As far as Peterson has talked about his popularity, I mean, he has asked himself this question, like, what the hell is going on? I mean, that's a quote. And one thing he keeps iterating, and I think he also says it during his Barron interview, but now I'm not so sure. Maybe that happened. Anyway, he will say, whenever I'm talking at some place, this moment I mention meaning, it just pin drops and everybody is hooked. And I think that's a huge part of it. And it's like, you know, the first video I just happened to find by the guy. I wasn't even looking for Peterson in particular. It's just this video about the necessity of virtue. And it's just, I watch it and I'm like, oh my God, this is, I'd never seen that, something in that. And then, you know.
That's an astounding thing to say about our culture, that when we see a video about virtue, we stop and stare because we don't talk about virtue. We don't glorify virtue. We don't hold virtue up for admiration.
It wasn't so much that. It was because I came from Stoicism, like, oh, let's watch something about virtue ethics, because I was trying this thing of analyzing my every action of the day, you know, to really practice Stoicism or focus on whatever the next thing you do. And I find this guy, and he talks about snakes and biology and Solzhenitsyn and Cain and Abel and the logos. And oh no, I'm enjoying somebody talking about religion, you know? this is about a year and a half ago, so give me a break. But that, and then you, Paul, with your analyses of the Harris and Peterson debates, which, like, that changed me. That video, literally, that destroyed a couple of my axioms. That's really difficult to deal with. I mean, I'm not trying to make light of it. I mean, so why do some of us click and leave And why do some of us stay? For me personally, there's this whole new existence in which I think life is worth living. And I'm still trying to figure out what to do with that life. And I figure maybe there'll be another video and I'll get a bit better at understanding what I should do with it. And in the meantime, I found that as something as simple, and I look, as we discussed yesterday, something as simple as telling the truth is so absolutely fundamental, so world-changing that, you know, it's such a tiny thing. I don't know, I'm preaching now, but like maybe there's more like that, and maybe we can find more if we talk to each other in conversations like this.
That's good.
It's like, well, Matt, Jeff, when we met, you know, you had all these ideas about Lewis and I don't know. I mean, if we'd met, I wouldn't have talked or thought about these things like that, or, you know, heard you read a whole blog post that you wrote about your thoughts. I think that's so interesting. And, you know, talking to Luke yesterday and, you know, your ideas about orthodoxy and about what belief is, and maybe we're just, maybe the those of us that stay, we want this, but we don't have it anywhere else. Because not everybody cares. Sorry, yeah. Paul, go ahead.
No, that's right. And the meaning, I mean, one of the things that I've continued to think about is the whole salience question, and that, because for the last, I don't have another video ready to go this week, and I've got a lot of conversations this week, and I just lost one of the best conversations I've had in the last few months. Just lost it. It's driving me crazy. But I spent a lot of last week getting through Frank Schaeffer's crazy for God, and salience. I start four or five books at a time, and every now and then one of those books grabs me and I've just got to finish it, and I want to make a video about it. And it's like, well, what is that? And it reminds me of Peterson's, you know, on the edge of the bed is going to become another meme for Peterson, because he's coming back around to it again and again. He did in the Bishop Barron video. But, you know, that was obviously there in the Sam Harris God Number One, God Number Two video, where Peterson, in a sense, sits on the edge of the bed, looks down into the darkness, speaks, you know, asks a question down into the darkness, and out comes an answer. And salience is like that. And so a lot of my questing has been, you know, what we say, well, we're going to do what's worthwhile, but where does that come from? I don't know. And God somehow, Holy Spirit, blowing wind. I've been doing a lot of thinking about spirit and wind and those issues. So, but it fascinates me, you know. So I actually said to a group, said, I just made a 2.5 hour video and I don't really have my next video in mind. Maybe I won't make any more. And last time I said something like that on the channel, I got a bunch of emails saying, no, you can't do that. It's like, well, I probably will make more, but, and I know I'll make more, but
I will send John your way.
John Van Donk. So I don't know. And I look at the meetups that we have in Sacramento, and they so often wind up so good. And I think, I didn't do this, you know, this is, so one of the, you know, community is forming around the people, you know, there's, I watch this thing happen. And I think, oh my goodness, it's just like a church, except, and then at some point I'm just sure the Holy Spirit's going to smuggle Jesus in, and we'll have more recovering atheists. I just watch it happen and hope to not get in the way.
But What do you mean, get in the way?
Well, now I'm just going to sound like Peterson. You know, do something stupid to forestall the progress. But I don't even know what the progress. That's not entirely true. You know, what do I want? So Peterson, when he talks to Bishop Aaron, Peterson asks Bishop Aaron, what does he want? And I know exactly what Bishop Aaron wants. I want the same thing. And I want the kingdom to come. I want the kingdom to come and all that means. I want children to be fed. I want people to be clothed. I want the insane to be in the right mind. I want wars to cease. I want all of this. And, you know, I see what I'm doing as a part of it. Absolutely. And part of why I can get away with this is I'm a Christian minister. So I can just say it. You know, what's your agenda, Vander Clay? It's always been my agenda. I don't think I've ever tried to hide it. I just don't like propaganda. I want people to speak the truth.
Well, and that's one of the things, that's been one of the big things about your channel that's kept me here when I don't follow a lot of Christian channels. I mean, I used to just, my podcast used to be exclusively sermons. And I mean, I don't listen to sermons on podcasts anymore at all because, I mean, I don't, that's a fundamental shift toward orthodoxy. I mean, the sermon is not the center of my Christian experience and worship. You don't have propaganda, which is why I like it. And that's I suppose I was thinking as you were talking, that's the common salience thing to me is that all of this, when you talked about bringing the kingdom, it's, and even with Jordan Peterson, and maybe this is his tie to clean up your own room and psychology and psychoanalysis and health and bringing people out of depression and away from nihilism into taking responsibility is that's all connected to health. And if you take individual health and you manifest it, like this is what Jordan Peterson talks about with it starting at the individuals, you clean your room. And then what's best for you is not only what's best for you, but it's what's best for your family. It's what's best for your neighborhood. It's what's best for your state. It's what's best for your country. It's what's best for the world. It's all the same thing. And if you get healthy, which Jordan Peterson, I would argue, is leading a lot of people to get healthy, at least in ways. I mean, they're cleaning up the rooms of their mind and stopping lying is what, you know, Job and I were talking about that. That's one of the first things you should do. And then you are assisting with that, even though you're within a narrow tribe of that, and you let people say whatever they want because you recognize the danger of propaganda. Those are the common things. If anybody came along the Jordan Peterson train or the Paul Vander Klaik train and they tried to take that and then colonize it and make a monarchical vision out of it that everybody else must submit to, I'm definitely out of that group fast. I want nothing to do with that.
Yeah, you know, what's one of the interesting things, so again, I talked to Nathan today, and you can watch Nathan's story on his book, on his movie, Becoming Fully Human, so I'm not telling any turn out of school here. So Nathan finds himself wanting to be Orthodox, and his wife isn't there, and so he goes to the priest, and the priest says, no, you don't become Orthodox until she's ready, and it takes 7 years. And what impressed me about him telling that story was the submission. I mean, in that moment, he submitted to his priest, and he submitted to his wife. And I think part of what I want to avoid is someone might hear what you just said, Luke, and have that sound like a rebellious spirit, just kind of, you know, Neo saying, I don't like people telling me what to believe or what to do. And it's true, none of us do it. But at the same time, there also has to be a point in which we submit, because you cannot be submitting, you cannot be a Christian without submitting to your Lord. It's the definition of the thing.
Right.
The difficulty, and then you have the question of what are the mediating authorities?
Sure.
And it's so often been the abuse of that authority that, you know, Luke and I, so in the conversation that I'll probably have to post it before I post this one, but the conversation Luke and I were having, you know, I made the point that the Protestant Reformation happened for a reason, and a big piece of that reason was corruption. And if there's one thing that the church reliably stumbles upon throughout church history, it's power. And the one thing that I think a lot are watching Jordan Peterson on is he has, you know, he's been a status rocket got attached to him, and he has gained in power and wealth and all of those things. You know, what does that do? And the incredible thing about Christianity is it deals with all of these questions of status and authority and power, and it's constantly reversing them. Jesus, who has the highest status, you know, Philippians 2, becomes the servant of all. And this got into American politics every time someone stands up and says, I'm a public servant. Mm. That's Christian language. And we all hear it, and the minute we see them acting not like a public servant, you know, where the revolution begins.
Yeah. Sorry, I want to say something else, but I don't want to talk the whole time. the thing in response to what you said about me is being rebellious, I would hearken back to your conversation with Eric. Because this is something I've thought a lot about, and admiration and respect, and Job and I spoke about yesterday, is that and respect is involuntary. It's something you do. You don't have control over. You either do or you don't respect someone. And so when it comes to the church and authority or any, I think when you talk about authority, you also need to talk about respect. And it is a false move to ask someone to submit to an authority they don't respect. It's a false move. And I think that's what the church has done a lot of times. And you can't do it. You're asking someone to lie. You're asking someone to sell their soul for the sake of your claimed authority. You ought not do that.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
I was saying this to Job. I fundamentally believe Christianity is non-coercive. And I think that's because it's all tied to respect. God doesn't force people to bend the knee. He woos them. They drop to a knee because they can't do anything else, which harkens back to a conversation I had recently too.
I think that harkens back to the height, elephant, and rider thing, right? Even if you get people to submit, if their elephants aren't in it, then they can't do anything other than what their elephant, you know, instinctually leads them to.
You make them split.
Yeah.
Like Jordan Peterson said, and then you have their head over here, pretend either lying or being self-deceived, thinking they're doing this. You either create hypocrites and duplicitous people or liars. Yeah. I mean, you can't do it. We are whole people. It all has to come together. I totally agree. That's elephant and rider for sure.
Keep going, Jeff. Were you done?
Well, I was going to say, I had a couple thoughts flash across my little keyhole consciousness. the admiration thing, I appreciated, you know, what Eric had to say in his conversation with you. And I think that's right. And I think that's echoing something that I believe it was in one of your conversations with Job, Paul, where, I referenced this in my conversation. He asked, you know, how do you get to Jesus? And, you know, Jesus came to me through my life, you know, the people in my life, everyone that I knew. And I think that is an admiration part of it too, right? What Luke just said earlier, you know, God will woo you, and it'll happen in so many different ways. It's funny. In a brief exchange with Job within the last couple weeks, I think, was when I was driving, and I don't know where I got this idea, but I just asked Job. I said, "Hey, I said something like, if you could have an experience where you actually believed probably isn't the right word, where you were convinced that you had an interaction with God number two, would you want it? And Job, do you remember what you said to me?
Oh God. I could think I would say yes to the question, but that I probably wouldn't believe it if it happened.
Yeah.
That sounds like me.
Yeah. And the thought that crossed my mind wasn't merely to ask Job that question, but it was, oh, you know, ask Job this question. And if he says, okay, yeah, sure, or something along those lines, then just go ahead and pray for something like that to happen for Job. And I told Job, hey, here's, you know, if you're okay with it, this is what I'll do. And he's like, yeah, I don't really see how if a being like this exists, I could do anything to stop that from happening anyway. And so I did, but I said, you know, it's not as if God number two, so to speak, does whatever I ask, but you know, I'll go ahead and ask and we'll see what happens. And if something happens, it will. And if it doesn't, it doesn't, and whatever. But, you know, all of the admiration piece, I guess just the last thing in that theme of you, Paul, talking to Job about how Jesus came to you, is, you know, I've read one Madeline L'Engle, well, three Madeline L'Engle books. It was a trilogy. It's called the Genesis Trilogy. And somewhere in one of those three books, she makes the exact same point that you did, is, you know, there's a lot of evangelizing out there. There's a lot of people who are trying to get you to come to Jesus, to get you to bend the knee to Jesus, and in Luke's language, get on my team kind of thing. And in her book, she said, you know, the most convincing arguments that I ever received, or that people that I even talked to have ever had, was, well, you know, I wasn't really interested in church. I wasn't really interested in the Bible, but I was interested when somebody that I really admired, I found out that they were a Christian. And that's what kind of drew me in. And you know, speaking of Madeline L'Engle, you know, admiration leads you to things. The only reason that I started reading Madeline L'Engle, or that I felt safe to read Madeline L'Engle, is because she said she admired C.S. Lewis. Mm. And so if somebody admires somebody that you admire, that's, you know, that gets my elephant's attention. I'm just, yep, like, oh, interesting. Yep. Luke, you like C.S. Lewis and you like McDonald. Okay, let me talk to you some more.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, that speaks to, I mean, that's why I read McDonald for the first time, was C.S. Lewis. I mean, I read what Lewis talked about, spoke about him, and what Chesterton said about him, and how all these people had such admiration. And that got me into McDonald. And I think that's how it works. Paul, and even, forgive me, your friend, the pastor who you spoke with, the author who writes the stories.
Rod Hugin. Rod. I admire Rod. Rod's
right.
The real deal.
Right, and I do too after watching his video. But like one of the, and I think it's the right move for you to have people like that on too, because the stories that he tells, there's a reason the stories that he tell are powerful. There's a reason they resonate so deeply with people. It's admiration. You can't hear about, and I forget the names, but the people who served, who gave up their lives for the people and the sacrifices they made.
Ruth.
Yeah, Pete and Ruth. I mean, you cannot, if you aren't moved by that story, I mean, I can't imagine someone not being moved by that story. And that's admiration. I mean, I do think there's a big piece there. And I mean, and I think that's a big piece with the saliency and the Jordan Peterson and your channel. I mean, I think that's what's going on.
There is a David French wrote a piece on National Review. The subtitle is one of the best pieces of it. Secular, and I don't want to go to the government thing, but secular government is breaking the promise of liberty, and the American church is breaking the promise of virtue. And that, you know, that idea, again, I've still got Frank Schaeffer's book ringing in my mind, and the, you know, Edith Schaeffer, you know, had crazy inconsistent ideas of status and virtue, which were all conflicting, and young Frankie could see that. Francis Schaeffer had a temper and didn't always treat his wife with the kindness that he should have, and there's inconsistency. But the thing that I think really grabbed Frank Schaeffer was the corruption of the evangelical industrial complex. In the, you know, and Luke, for conversations with you, that's a continually revolving aspect of the conversation, that in our search for power and our search for money, you know, we so easily turn to lying and propaganda, and somehow we know, somehow we can, when something is a lie, we don't want to have anything to do with it, yet we are liars. And that is the crazy thing. This thing that we can see and abhor in others, we can't stop ourselves from indulging in. And that is, you know, that is some, you know, the nature of our broken, sinful nature. And you know, what grabbed people about Peterson, I think his earnestness and his conviction, that always gets our attention, but, you know, will it hold? And it was amazing in the conversation with Bishop Barron that Peterson at one point, and I'm going to put these in, I'm going to make videos about some of these clips in here, but this place where Peterson starts basically saying, well, part of the abdication of the church is that they don't tear into people anymore and tell them that they're sinners. And I thought, oh my, Jordan, you really haven't been in church, and you don't know the interesting dynamic of calling people out on their sin. There have been many cases in my ministry where people have come to me and said similar things. You need to call out this person on their sin. And I would say to them, is that a value of yours? Yeah, that's what you should be doing, Pastor. And so I'd say, okay, shall I start with you?
Boom.
Never ends well.
That's when the little animated sunglasses go come down. You
know? Somebody's going to make that. Somebody's going to make that. What minute are we in on this video? Somebody pause it. Go back and get
that. So this, you know, and this again, I mean, part of why, you know, Luke is, all kinds of people are leaking out to orthodoxy and stuff, but I remain a Calvinist, partly because I look at the complexities of this world, and I have to say, it's only by God's power and spirit that we can be saved from ourselves, because we are so, I have so many ways of lying to myself. I have so many ways of deceiving myself. I have so many ways and if I can do that to myself, you know, why can't I do that to others in my life? We are so deceitful. And
oh, can I butt in on that? Okay.
I knew this was happening.
Where are my notes? Yeah. Okay. So, Paul, recently you made this video about, oh Lord, what am I doing? About Peterson, how can anyone say they believe in God?
Yeah.
And then there was a 2.5-hour, your very latest one.
My last video. No more after that.
Yeah, done. Over. No more Vanderclay. Okay. there was a video, my cat's whining at me, sorry. There was a video in that, and who was the name?
John Piper.
John Piper.
That clip, Paul.
That clip triggered a lot of people. Tell me how it triggered
you. Oh, man. That pissed me off.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I got so frustrated by that. I was watching it. I watched it twice. And I'm like, Mallory, come here. Watch this. This is horrible. So it's this. It's not even the music. The music doesn't help. But it's this, it highlights some sort of a diabolical, abusive relationship of you are a despicable, worthless creature and you don't deserve anything. But I'm going to give it to you anyway because I love you. Like, really? Is that how this is? It's like, well, you know, I don't want to beat you, but you keep pissing me off, honey. I just can't help it. That's what that reminds me of. It's like, oh, so I'm a horrible fallen creature and I don't deserve grace, but I get it anyway. Really? So who made that creature? Can you remind me who made this creature that doesn't deserve grace to begin with? And if it's so important, why is faith a gift? Why don't I get it when I'm born? If it decides my eternal salvation, really, you're gonna give this to me halfway? And so I might feel a bit strong about this, but no, honestly, I do I misunderstand the theology? Because this really. Is that how? Because that's the whole that goes into these shitty atheist arguments of the burglar in the alley who's like, well, you can decide not to give me a wallet, but then I'll shoot you. So it's really up to you to condemn yourself or not, which doesn't seem like a very proper argument. But it seems to me that something that is so utterly, utterly important. And that's where Peterson steps in. Peterson says, no, wait a second. You're not a child. You're not an infant who needs to be given something. No, here's something for you to carry. And through that, you'll reach salvation. And that works. That's Pelagius, man. That's like, suffer up that hill, bucko.
That's orthodox.
That orthodoxy is Pelagian?
No, I think, well, so the whole Pelagius, it was interesting. I would love to talk to Job sometime about what he read about Pelagius. My understanding...
Wiki page. Wiki page.
Okay. Right. And so I've read that too. And my understanding of Pelagius is that, and this is what happened with all heretics, they burned all their writings. So what we know about the heretics are what the people who called them heretics said about them. That's just one thing. But if I read Pelagius's Wikipedia page, which I did too, I was like, I don't even think Pelagius is a Pelagian. That's what I thought when I read the Wikipedia page. I don't think, and this gets into what Paul and I, we didn't talk about this in our chat, but I would love specifically to have you talk to Dr. Nathan Jacobs about, because he knows way more than me. I mean, he understands Reformed doctrine very well. And my see that's the thing that happens is we I was telling Paul this, we have these Augustinian frameworks and we come into this conversation and then we'll call something Pelagian. Well, that's an Augustinian framework. That's not what we're talking about. We're having a like orthodoxy. I mean, if you want to call theosis and carrying a cross up the hill and following Christ, taking up your cross and following me, Pelagian, I guess go ahead, call it Pelagian. I mean, I just call it being a Christian. Mm.
So what's interesting to me, Job, about your reaction is that I could compile Jordan Peterson clips to nearly make those John Piper quotes. Because Jordan, you can find Jordan Peterson telling you, you don't know your hand from your butt. You have no idea which way is up. Peterson gets on that often. Now, Peterson is not a believer that God, well, Peterson via the One More Thought conversation with David Nasser.
I mean, another trigger point.
Yeah. he's clearly right there in the question of agency. And here's the difficult, well, this is in a sense what the West has been working on for 1500 years via Augustine, is where is God's agency and where is our agency? Because even if you, let's say, okay, so let's go full Pelagian. Let's say, well, okay, so maybe I'm not the dimwit that Augustine says I am. Maybe I have enough of a spark of divinity to carry that, to even have the good sense of picking up the right cross and choosing the right hill. When I get to the top of the hill, I'm going to sing with Frank Sinatra, "I Did It My Way." And I don't think that finally works either. I don't know how to, and see, and I wonder, yeah, I know Luke. Luke wants in on this. I think all of these questions are framed within a lot of different backgrounds. And part of the difficulty we have in conversation is that we're using this tiny little channel, pulling from a very limited set of words to try and make this thing work and fit. And I'm not trying to say, I'm not trying to punt by using the word mystery or paradox, but these questions, you very quickly fall off the other end and you say, well, then it's just up to us. And I think a lot of this hinges on the question of, we don't know when God is working and we don't know when I am. And so as a Calvinist, I tend to feel more comfortable not trusting in me, because I know just how untrustworthy I am. All right, Luke, go ahead. You want to?
Well, I just want to, I want to mention this so it gets in the notes, but if you...
I stopped taking notes.
Oh, well, I'll email you.
I'm
going
to have to make notes in the aftermath.
Oh, sorry. So Dr. Nathan Jacobs has a podcast with Hank Hanegraaff where I think he talks about what you were just mentioning. He talks about a lot of things, but he talks about what you were just mentioning really way in a way that I think you can, that's really clear. But I think it's essentially the distinction in the early church fathers. And he argues, he says, you really need it to understand the New Testament too, but the difference between energies and essences and the energies that are in the Bible. Because I would argue that you can have both an incredible seriousness of sin and of your own, I won't use the word depravity because that's a word that triggers and has a lot of baggage, but you have your own brokenness, fallenness, sin. I agree with John Piper. You are much worse than you can imagine. I affirm that. I don't think that's wrong. However, I think at the same time, because of Augustine and through the dominance of worldviews like original sin and total depravity, we lost the fact that man is heaven and earth together. We have the divine spark. We have God in his energies is not the dualistic God, that's the deistic God that's out there. He's also in us. He's out and in. He's everywhere. This is why I talk about panentheism. So like the Pelagian dragging your cross up a hill, it's impossible. It's a false category. If you drag your cross up the hill and there you meet Christ and you're in union with him, you can't do that on your own. Of course not. There is no such thing. It's like it's a round circle, or it's a round square.
How so?
Because anything good comes from God. That's what James, the brother of God, says. All good things come from God. And the only reason that would even trigger you is because you have dualistic categories.
Oh, is that so? I wouldn't know. I honestly wouldn't know, man. But I did identify a lot of dogma I have, so I'll admit to that.
I mean, the only one I can see. I shouldn't speak so. I tend to say things strongly, so forgive me if that was overstated.
Okay. Let me put it this way. I'd rather walk with someone up the hill than be dragged up it. And that's what it feels like lately, and I'd rather be climbing. I don't like to be dragged, and then I fell back down, and that was 2 weeks of shit. So, okay, I clearly need to get up that hill. But
so that sounded like a Calvinist. You're being dragged up the hill.
That's what it feels like. It's not like I want to deal with all this religion. Ideas have people.
yeah, but, quote that. Hashtag.
It's just Jung. but honestly, if you're saying all good comes from God, where does it? Okay. So how do we prevent humans from becoming infantilized by the necessity of God, or by the necessity of grace?
I think we can prevent it. I think that's how we start.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe. I mean,
just
I don't
flesh out what you mean. I'm not sure broken. I know what you mean.
Well, I don't think humans are broken.
Well, I think that's where, and when I hear something like that, I think, okay, explain the world.
But you think you're broken in ways. I mean, yeah. Just think of it this way. Like because we have all these sin categories, sin is just missing the mark. Another word for it, like you could easily translate I believe it's in 1 Timothy, but when Paul's telling Timothy, like, do everything that accords with sound doctrine, another way that you could translate sound doctrine is health. The Greek word that's translated that, you could equate with health. So, I mean, there are definitely human beings that are in unhealth.
Yes, agreed. But I don't think that the ability to choose good and evil is defines us as broken. I think that defines us as in working order. If we could only do one and not the other.
Well, that's, yeah, again, that's Augustinian and total depravity and original sin.
Damn it. Sorry, Pastor.
I thought you didn't like labels.
Oh.
Okay, so how am I interpreting that video wrong?
Here's again the point I was trying to make before. It is really hard to describe a human being, especially with a sentence or even a paragraph, because on one hand, we are these creatures that are made in the image of God and have an astounding capacity for nobility, brilliance. We are royalty, but one way that Neil Planninga says we are fallen royalty. So we're trying to figure out how to describe human beings in their state. And, you know, I think about at the end of, which book was this of Keller's? He tells the story of Eric Little. Eric Little was an American sprinter. The movie Chariots of Fire was made about him. Eric Little was a missionary in China, and when the Japanese invaded, he went into an internment camp along with all the other American missionaries and expats who were there. The Japanese put them all together. And I'd have to look up the resource. I've read it on one of my videos once, but there was a guy who wasn't a Christian who was in that camp. And so you'd think, well, this camp made up of all of these missionaries, well, that would be, you know, it should be a stellar experience. And he said, as food was short and as circumstances were horribly confined, these missionaries became just as game playing and as horrible as everyone else. The only exception was Eric Little, who was known in that camp as being consistently loving and selfless. And it seemed the worse the camp would get, you know, the brighter he shone. And then, of course, he dies. And it's experiences like these that draw us to ask, that draw us to try to talk about this. Now, in some ways, the story itself is better than my capacity to theologically describe it. And it's that reality that, see, and I don't know, it's so often we can't get beyond some of these things. And so you have the question of, you have the question of divine election in Calvinism, and people kvetch about that. But I look at that and say, well, so you have a problem with that. Well, how do you explain the fact that I grew up with Stan and Barb in Paterson, New Jersey, and, you know, has had 3 square meals a day and wonderful opportunities and advantage? And how many of the children that I saw and worked with in the Dominican Republic who are Haitians have nowhere near what I have at all? So you have a problem with divine election, but you don't have the problem with the kind of selection we see around us. I can't answer those questions about why I have been given so much and others so much less. But I do know that there are things that happen in this world that speak of another. And C.S. Lewis writes about this, I think, very well in the beginning. To get Jeff into the conversation, Jeff, we don't want you to be a bystander. At the beginning of Mere Christianity, where there seem to be whispers of another world. And the problem, the part of the reason I don't have a problem with a loving God, psychologically, maybe it was because I had wonderful parents. But if I look at it rationally, the thought that if God is anything but love, if that is the case, then basically anything that we do here and now is, for the most part, completely meaningless. Because if God is a tyrant, we are so lost and so screwed at a level that we can't even begin to think about. And the real question about this world is not, why is there so much bad? It's, why is there so much good? And Peterson sees that, which I really appreciate about him. So I should shut up. I talk too long. I have videos to talk on. I shouldn't talk here so much.
That's one of the things that me and Luke talked about is, you know, it seems like whenever anybody has a conversation with you, they're doing all the talking, and we wanted you to do a little bit of talking. So I think it's okay. But something, Job, that you said in your initial when you articulated what your response was to that Piper video, it's something that has been in the recesses of my mind for the longest time. And the first time I ever tried to articulate it was last night. I was talking with Esther a little bit, and I said, you know, and I shared this with Luke a little bit too, I think. Maybe I'm a heretic too, so maybe this is my heresy, but it's that piece about what you said, Job, is like, who plopped me down into this existence where I have this ability to, it depends on the tradition, it depends on the strand of Christianity, I guess, but if you were to say, yeah, you have a sin nature, you're born with it. Okay, well, I didn't ask to be born with it. And that's fine, right? My conception of God is not the one that tells me you need to feel like garbage because you have this in your nature. I don't in my heart believe that is what God is saying to any of us. I think my heresy comes in potentially when I say God says, nope, the way that you were made and the way that you got plopped down, that's on me. I'm taking it on me. Literally, I'm taking that to the cross. It's all on me. And then everything that you do from there is yours. You do with what I give you what you will. And the sin, Jeff, that you are responsible for is all the times that you choose anything other than me. All the times that you've ever chosen to do wrong instead of right. When you knew what the right thing to do was and you chose to do the wrong thing, that is your responsibility in a certain sense. But guess what? I'm also throwing in what I did on the cross to cover that too, because I love you that much. I'm glad that we don't burn heretics at the stake anymore.
Well, there's oceans and continents between us, so it'd be hard to get at each other.
So there's, not to make this too theologically nerdy, but I think what you basically articulated in talking to us
now.
Well, and since you were talking to Esther, I mean, that sounds a lot like Arminianism and libertarian free will, and through all this conversation, maybe I tell my Orthodox friends and like my priest that sometimes people will ask me Orthodox opinions and things. And I'm like, listen, I've been going to the Orthodox church for like a year. So, I mean, I speak about it, what I know, but
heard about hardly any sermon.
What?
In the Orthodox church.
Oh yeah. The sermons are small, but you're being formed by the liturgy, Paul. it seems like we're framing it. What I keep hearing a lot, and this is probably the embedded Orthodox that's been being formed in me, there's a lot of discussion about choice. And I don't know, I think I've shared with you, Jeff, before, yeah. Father Stephen Freeman's, he has a little lecture on choice.
Yeah.
And he says that Americans especially tend to focus much too much on choice, because really, like, if you follow the logic down causally, and this is where I would agree with Job, I mean, ultimately the buck stops with God. If you're talking about theodicy and the problem of evil and all those sorts of things, I mean, that's where atheists aren't wrong within that framework. But I would suggest a couple things. George MacDonald's sermon on justice is phenomenal. I think everyone should read it. And then this is one of the things that I wrote down that I didn't get to in my discussion with Paul. But so Father Stephen Freeman quoted Gregory of Nyssa in his lecture on modernity that he gave recently in Seattle. And I've been, when he said this, you talk about saliency, it just went boom. And I mean, and I think I'll be trying to understand this sentence for the rest of my life, but I think it's true. So St. Gregory said this. He said, the journey toward salvation is marked by a successive elimination of all that we have in order to reach what we are.
Toward salvation is marked by a successive
elimination of all that we have in order to reach what we are. And I'll email you the lecture. But it's a, why that struck me so much is, like I told Paul, and I've been really getting into Gabriel Marcel, who's this French existentialist, but one of his primary books is called On Being and Having and the Distinction Between the Two. And I think choice and volition is caught up in, I would just say it this way, choice and volition and that framework, agency, is caught up, I mean, depending on how you parse it out, agency is complicated, but is caught up in the world of having. Your thoughts, your egoic mind, your intellect, it's caught up in the world of having. what you are, I would say, is most the goal of what we should be and what God calls us to be in our beingness and our are-ness in the way of Gregory Nyssa, I think is best illustrated by the Green Lady in Perelandra. And I'll just leave it at that, because stories explain better than my propositions.
I don't know that reference.
So that is, in my first discussion with Paul, I talked about C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, because I also, like Jeff, love C.S. Lewis. And that's his second book in the C.S. Lewis Space Trilogy. Is called Perelandra. And when you, I think the childlikeness that we're called, the innocent as doves, wise as serpents, I think all of those things are illustrated incredibly well in narrative form in that book. And I think what that green, at the end, when you see, I mean, this is a spoiler alert, but at the end of the book, when you see perfected man and woman, they are fully in the world of what they are. They have ceased to be in the world of what they have. And I think, actually, I think what that book is the unman, the demon character. It's essentially a Garden of Eden story. The Satan character in that book is essentially trying to make her live in the world of have. Hmm. And he does it over and over. Throughout that book. I mean, just it's illustration after illustration, but that, and so, I mean, I just, the focus on, I would just say that total depravity and original sin and being born in that is repulsive to God is not an Eastern framework. So if you're equating that to the totality of Christianity, just know you don't have to. That's all I would say.
I don't know. We're getting a little close to some Orthodox propaganda here.
They have cookies, I've heard.
Well, John Van Donk has harder stuff in his living room.
Yeah. Oh, Job and I talked about whiskey, too. We're both Scotch fans.
Yeah. Although I'm having Dutch Geneva this evening.
Ooh.
There's no question that trying to relate, you know, it's a telling thing that one of the things that human beings have been trying to do nonstop is to attempt to represent reality in how many different media they possess. Language, books, clay drawings, paint, film, and it's kind of a strange humanist Turing test. Can we represent reality good enough to fool each other? And still haven't done it. And theology is obviously a language that is obviously a means that attempts to do that. Of course, the challenge of something like the Bible, I think perhaps what the Bible is a representation of reality that is intended to shock us into a clearer picture rather than the, you know, I love the part, the beginning of Peterson's conversation with Roger Scruton, when Peterson talks about, you know, how what we see are these memories in front of us all the time. And lately, both in the Sydney conversation and in the Bishop Barron conversation, Peterson's been, he's got these throwaway, we've got these pieces of the conversations that are about consciousness that I think we're all looking for the gotcha tribal, the things we're paying attention to. But those conversation elements, those consciousness elements of the conversations, I think are some of the most important ones, because we're so desperately trying to represent reality. And I think it's at that moment that if we ask ourselves, why are we trying to represent reality? And I think it's because if we arrive at a representation of reality, I believe we hope to be able to get our hands on it and manipulate it. And I think it's in that moment that we become like God. And it's for that reason that on one hand, God makes us sub-creators and says, please make and remake, make glory for me. I want to see my children do what I do. But in that one moment, we try and get our hands on it, and our hearts, are bent on taking glory from. And in every case we do that, we diminish glory. So this is part of the idolatry of theology and philosophy and language that we keep. On one hand, as God's children, encouraged by God to represent and to create, we're trying to do this. But on the other hand, our greedy hearts take it and then use it to become Sauron.
Hmm.
I don't know if that made any sense.
It did to me. So, sorry, I feel like I'm talking too much. Just tell me to shut up, Jeff. Text me and tell me to shut up if I'm talking.
Oh, he muted himself. Somebody muted him.
I muted him.
Yeah. Oh, perfect.
I took power and I muted Luke.
You should. If I talk too much, you have my permission.
Oh, Paul, you're turning into not the person I thought you were. And
it's I'm done
That's
with this.
It. No more videos, no more watching. Closing the channel. I'm corrupted.
So in the Dr. Nathan Jacobs, I want you to re-record a video and have it on your show, because I just repeat what he says. In his podcast with Hank Hanegraaff, he talks about the balance. They talk about the balance between mystery and reason and where that proper line is and how the early church fathers balance that really well, because reason is our gift to get to things. But he said all of our thinking is analogical. We think by comparison. You think it's like this, it's like that. That's how all of your thinking happens. But the problem is when you're talking about God, when you get to certain things, you reach a point where there is no more analogy. To go into an analogy is to make a mistake.
Right.
And that's where you have to go to mystery, because you have nothing else. It's beyond your comprehension. He said the phrase in English, to wrap your mind around, he said, is actually telling, because what that means is to circumscribe. You wrap your mind around something. You can't do that with God. Right. He's ineffable. Right. So that's where you punt to mystery. He said there's an appropriate place to do it. You can do it way too early and be inauthentic, to just be like, it's mystery, it's mystery, it's mystery. That's just lazy. But to try to reason things that you cannot is a mistake too. And I don't know if that speaks to what you're talking about, but that's the proper use of language, I think. But then when you use language in a way that's manipulative and to control, I mean, that's propaganda. That's George Orwell. That's the opposite of, that's Antichrist. It's anti-logos.
Well, we use language to represent, which is what we're doing all the time, then you get into the question of motivation. So am I using it in order to take, I always liked, I forget his name right now. He's a pastor, Greg, the pastor in Minnesota.
Greg Boyd?
Greg.
Boyd?
Boyd, yes, Greg Boyd. He had power over versus power under. And I really liked that distinction that he used. And I very much agree. The crazy thing about Christianity is, here in the 10th command, in the 10 commandments, God says, you shall not make a representation of me, because the only elements you have to use in order to try to make a representation of me come from my creation. And yep. I make the point in my Sunday school class that would be like a person who makes cakes, a statue of a cake representing the cake maker. And God so clearly says, no. Jesus comes along And Jesus fills us with imagery of the Father. And Job, your point about, you know, if you have a hard time with that clip from John Piper, you know, read some of the things that Jesus says, ask anything in my name and it shall be given. You know, your Father in heaven loves to give you this, and it's dramatically generous. And just by using the word Father, which of course the Muslims know, because and for this point, that Father brings a reference of God in that is so powerful. So there's so much going on here that's really hard to deal with. That's part of the reason I have no problem with people sitting down and telling me their honest heresies, because if you look at this stuff, yeah, and if you don't, if exclamation marks aren't going off, you're not paying attention, because it's something.
Okay, so I'm not a pastor, so I'm way out of my depth here. So, look, Jesus seems to bring that stuff a bit differently, though. I mean, doesn't he? And, you know, because, oh, man, I shouldn't have started this. it's like fighting a bear. Look, even when you would try to approach Jesus, you know, because Jesus doesn't say, oh, you know, maybe he doesn't, I just glossed over it. he just say, oh, you're this terrible fallen creature, you know, you wretched thing that breathes. It's like, no, you have the potential to walk on water if you apply yourself properly. So that's encouraging. That's what Peterson says. People need encouragement. And it's like, well, you know, kiddo, you're screwed. Basically, admit it to yourself. It's like a schoolyard bully who says, hey, twerp, I could beat you up, but I'm not gonna. I'm gonna be nice to you. You'd better worship me for it. That's not very encouraging. That's tyranny with extra steps. That's just, but saying, hey, you can walk on water. Come on, just give it a shot. You've seen me do it. That's how easy this is, see? And you go and try it. Come on, you climb up that hill. I'll show you how it's done.
But that gets to Luke's point, because he only walks on water when he's looking at Jesus. Mm. And it's when he looks at the waves that he sinks.
This yeah.
And you know, so the quote, I mean, Jesus says, ask and it shall be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. And he who seeks finds. And the one who knocks, the door will be open. Which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give you a stone? Or if he asks for fish, will give you a snake? If you then, though you are evil... I mean, he puts it right together. That's the thing about Jesus. He takes these two things that you say, these things can't go together. And Jesus takes them and says, here they are. Ask whatever you want, because your Father is so generous. And we hear that and we say, I don't dare believe that. Okay. And you're right, Job. You're right. Because Peter, he says to Peter, you know, first they think Jesus is a ghost, and Jesus says, no, it's me. And Peter says, well, if it's you, bid me to come. And Jesus says, come on. And he walks, and he looks at the waves, and he sinks. And Jesus says, oh, good try. Atta boy, next time we'll get it. Jesus says, you of little faith.
I just show you how to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
okay.
I'm sorry, Joe. I shouldn't have done.
No, it's this is great, because I was probably going to be wrong anyway. Naturally, I'm trying to adopt Christianity to my preconceived notions on how it should be. I can't help that.
We're all trying to adopt God in the same way.
I mean, as a person named Job, I feel kind of I should be telling God how to run things.
Oh. Well, I appreciate you, you know, bringing those up, Paul, because it is so easy to fall into seeing Jesus in one way, and you know, the gentle Jesus, meek and mild. But no, he's a lion too, and this was a story that I told Job whenever we met for lunch. I said, you know, there's a portion in, I want to say, the Silver Chair from the Chronicles of Narnia, and I couldn't remember the girl's name. I should have looked it up, but
yeah, with the river.
Yes,
that stuck in my mind, man. something.
Do you know this scene, Paul, from the Silver Chair, where she gets separated from the boy character? I think it's Eustace in that story.
It's Paul. Paul's with her, him, right? It's Paul and Eustace and Puddleglum in the Silver Chair.
Yeah, and. It wasn't me reading this story that made this resonate with me. It was, you know, I talked about the pastor that I would listen to all the time out there in California, Mark Foreman. He told this story once in one of his sermons, and it just like resonated with me, and it's always stuck with me since then. And in the story, I think her name is Jill. She's like been wandering around in the wilderness, and she's like parched, like she's dying of thirst, and she's just worn out from the day, and she's lost. She comes across this beautiful, clear stream, and her, you know, her spirits just start to rise by seeing it. And she's like, oh, finally, I can go get a drink. And she goes to get a drink, and then she sees that there's this huge lion sitting in the middle of the stream. And she's like, oh, no, I dare not go get a drink. And she says to the lion, can you go away, please, so I can have a drink of water? If you don't, I'll die. And he's like, I'm not going anywhere. And she says, well, if you're not going to go anywhere, can you at least promise not to eat me? I make you no promises, he says. Mm-hmm. And she says, well, do you eat people? And he says something along the lines of, I've eaten kings. I've eaten... It's just terrifying, right? Yeah. And he says, but you know what? Yeah, if you don't drink, you'll die. You have to drink this water. Yeah. And that's about as far as I went with it in the story. But, you know, that's a picture. That's one of Lewis's genius gifts, is he can paint the image of Christ as he displayed himself in the Gospels in ways that just completely get past our minds, right? That talk to our elephants.
And I didn't really see Christ in it, but I did think it was a really good story.
Well, in Narnia, Christ is basically represented by that lion throughout all different portions of the story. And Lewis shows so many different snapshots of Jesus as he was portrayed in the Gospels in the form of this lion. And when he shows up, which is very sporadically, and how he interacts with the main characters. And that's just one of the pictures where it talks about, yeah, I am the source of all life in this river here. And for you to be able to drink it, you also have to risk losing your life to me.
Yeah, I can't make the... How does Jesus represent death by mauling versus death by thirst? No, I got it. That's a serious question.
It's a good question.
That's a Jordan Peterson question. So which do you want, death by mauling or death by thirst? There you are. All life is suffering.
Well, that's no easy choice, eh?
There's another picture that he paints that might help a little bit more, and I swear this came up in some conversation that you had, Paul. It might have been with Ron Dart, maybe not. But it's in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where the same character that I referenced before, Eustace, he's just this scoundrel of a bratty kid. And he goes off, he gets pulled into Narnia with his, are they his cousins? I think they're his cousins. And he goes and wanders off, and he finds this pile of gold in a cave, and he finds this bracelet that he really likes, and he's going to just take it with him. And he puts this bracelet on, and it turns him into this horrible dragon. And in my interpretation, the imagery is he basically takes on the exterior of what his interior life looks like, how wretched and terrible of a little snot-nosed kid that he is. And he puts this bracelet on, and it turns him into this horrific, scary-looking dragon. And he tries to go back to his cousins and the party that he's with, and they don't recognize him. They're just like, oh my gosh, it's this horrible dragon that's trying to attack us. And he has to run off because they don't recognize him. They're scared of him. They want to fight him. And he's desperate. He knows that this bracelet is what has trapped him into being this dragon. And he's gotten so big that it's swollen onto his arm or his wrist, and he cannot get it off. He tears at it. He claws at it. He can't get it off. He lands. He's flying around. He lands, basically distraught. And the lion shows up. The lion starts talking to him, and he basically says, there's only one way for you to get out of this. You're going to have to let me claw your dragon skin off of you. I'll tear it away. I'll make it go away. But you have to submit to this very difficult, very painful, very agonizing process. And, you know, Lewis doesn't pull any punches in how he describes the tearing away of the skin. And the way that it's described, if I'm remembering right, and, you know, Paul and Luke, you guys can call me on this. He describes it as it's agonizing pain, but it's also inexpressible pleasure at the same time, because his regular skin, his humanity, is being restored with each claw and each tear that's destroying and ripping away this false him that is that dragon imagery.
I was just going to say that I couldn't undress because I hadn't any clothes on, when suddenly the thought that dragons are snaky sort of things, and snakes can cast their skins, of course, thought I, that's what the lion means. So I started scratching myself, and my scales began coming off all over the place. And then I scratched a little deeper, and instead of just scales coming off here and there, my whole skin started peeling off beautifully, like it does after an illness, or as if I was a banana. In a minute or two, I stepped out of it. I could see it lying there beside me, looking rather nasty. It was a most lovely feeling. So I started to go down to the well for my bath. And I'm not sure if that's the piece. I'm just looking at it fast. So, but no, you're right. And this is so hard to capture. So here's the question. Do you come to Jesus because you want him, or do you come to Jesus because you need him? Well, kind of both, but it's not really the same kind of wanting, because, again, as Peterson says in the Dare I Say I Believe in God video, we are not masters of our own houses. We don't know what we want, and what we want when, and what we want how. And that's where I don't really have a problem seeing people as really quite small and not terribly bright, because that's how I know myself to be. And I also don't see us radically differentiated from the story. I mean, when we pull these kinds of things, you know, would I be, you know, how would I be if I were a woman? I wouldn't be me.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be a not terribly attractive woman running around. You know, it's kind of okay, splitting Paul. Ourselves from our story.
So Esther wrote this article recently. It made me think of it, because she said, what if you tear off the dragon skin and you find more dragon skin beneath? And I thought that was an odd sentence, but it makes sense now.
Yeah, Paul, something that you said just reminded me of a. I'm sorry, I'm monopolizing with C.S. Lewis instead of my ideas, but I just wanted to read this really quick. This is an excerpt from The Problem of Pain, which I mentioned before is my absolute favorite Lewis book. Lewis says, "It is a poor thing to pledge our allegiance," and I'm paraphrasing there, "to God when the," again paraphrasing, "when the ship of our lives is sinking under us. A poor thing to come to him as a last resort, to offer up our own when it is no longer worth keeping. If God were proud, he would hardly have us on such terms. But he is not proud. He stoops to conquer. He will have us even though we have shown that we prefer everything else to him and come to him because there is, as we might say, nothing better now to be had."
Paul, if I don't think I talked to you about this, but I think I mentioned it to my priest. So you spoke with Eric, you spoke about silence, right? Yeah, I think this is silence, the movie Silence and the book Silence, Shuzaku Endo. Are you guys familiar? The movie Scorsese made it into a movie a couple years ago.
I never saw it.
I haven't seen the movie.
I strongly, strongly recommend it. The book is phenomenal. But there is I guess spoiler alert. But the central scene in the movie is there are in Japan, I forget the time, I believe it was the 1700s. But there were a couple, I forget the order. I think they were Franciscans.
I thought they were Jesuits.
No, they were Jesuits. You're right. Priests from Spain were sent over to Japan to kind of resurrect the church because there had been some emperors in Japan that had essentially completely squelched Christianity from Japan. But one of the things that they would do to stomp out Christianity, because it was mainly... at the time was mainly Catholic, I think, or this was centered around Catholicism. These are Jesuit priests, they had this, essentially like an icon or an image or a symbol that would have a cross or the Virgin Mary or something on it called a fumi. And they would make people renounce their faith. They would set it on the ground and they would make you step your foot on it. Symbolically is a pretty significant move, you know, like it's beneath my feet, the bottom of your shoe, all that stuff. And, especially in a Japanese culture. And so this is something, the movie is set up around that. And there's a great hero of the movie. He's this Father Rodriguez who is going over there when all the Christians are underground and persecuted, you know, all this, they're, being made to step on the fumi and all these things. And eventually, he's captured. Yeah. And eventually Rodriguez is captured and he gets to this like climactic moment, where there's a fumi and he's, you know, and the whole movie is just going back and forth. Like you almost feel like his capture is inevitable and you're like, what's this guy going to do? Like, is he going to deny everything he is in his Christ and step on this thing, renounce his faith? Is he going to cave? Or is he going to be a hero? Is he going to be martyred? You know, what's going to happen? All the Japanese Christians are looking to him as their hope, as, you know, as their priest, as their father, their earthly, you know, the earthly representation. And he gets to this point, and I remember when I was reading the book, I was reading in a public place, Rodriguez is set before the fumi, and, you know, he's having this moment. Everything's been leading to this. And he essentially, I believe he has a vision or he hears a voice and it says, step, step. It's for this world that it's for this reason that I came into the world, is to be shamed. And it's, when you said that about God's humility and his, you know, I think of Philippians 2, you know, Christ as the image of God, who did not count equality with God something to be grasped. He didn't seek to have it, but made himself nothing, taking on the form of a servant, even a servant who gave it up to death, and death alone, and shamed and spit on. That is the icon of God. That's what God is. And I think the movie Silence, in that moment, the resolution of the book is, I mean, it's so beautiful. I mean, it kind of leaves it in limbo. Like, what is the fate of this Rodriguez? What does that mean? What does it mean to step on the Fumi? Like, does that mean you're not a Christian? Does it mean you've renounced your faith? And my take on it, you know, to speak to your point of God not being proud, I require mercy, not sacrifice. God, and this is where I would hearken back to the, I don't know, the George MacDonald justice sermon, is God is infinite in all of his attributes. He is just, but he's also merciful, and he's also love, and all of them are infinite. And he's good.
That's the more than that Jonathan Edwards has, these God and his diverse excellencies. You don't expect to hear the distinct instruments of the orchestra at that voltage, or at that volume, still scaling up. You'd expect the tubas to drown out the violins, let's say. But God and his diverse excellencies, they don't drown out. They keep going. And no, that's, you know, trample, trample. It is to be trampled on by you that I am here. And my conversation with Eric, too, it's so fun to see what conversations do. And so my second conversation with Eric, when he talked about, you know, his friends mocking Jesus, and Jesus is unmockable, because and he's on the cross, and, you know, he saved others, but he can't save himself. And to me, I always, in that moment when I read that, I think, no, he's saving others by not saving himself. And this is Peterson always says, well, it's archetypal, you can't get around it. Well, this is the aspect of the story you can't get around, because that's how the story works. And
yeah, when you were talking about walking on water, I was bringing up to you the book Loris, and there's a line from it, one of the most significant lines from it that stood out to me is, because you talk about death, and it's the main character, one of his name is Arseny, and it says, know, O Arseny, that only he who does not fear drowning is capable of walking on water. And it's, because Job, I would agree with you. I agree with both of what Paul and you were saying in that instant, but that's what Jesus did. And I mean, I think one of the only books of the Bible that early on in my faith, I did like the John MacArthur Bible study method. And the first year that I was serious about my faith, all I did was study the book of 1 Corinthians. That's all I did. I read it over and over and over and over and over, and marked it and made graphs and made sentence diagrams. And it's still to this day, I mean, it's deep, deeply within me. But the first three chapters of 1 Corinthians are on the way of the world versus the way of Christ. And the way of Christ seems like folly to the world because it's fundamentally of a different character. It doesn't use power. It doesn't use violence. It doesn't use coercion. It doesn't use manipulation. It uses self-death, self-denial, suffering, servant, love. And that's why, I mean, it's one of the most profound and simple things there is, but it's not simple to do, as any significant in your life will will demonstrate to you. Because you have to act like Christ, essentially, to have any relationship in your life go well.
Yeah, that's the truth. Or to have the most significant. You can go okay with your supermarket if you act like a, but to be with your children and to be with your spouse,
yeah,
you give your life, and it's the, and I often tell people, I says, if you live like Christ, you will die like Christ and you'll be raised like Christ. And then of course they only get to the die like Christ and said, yeah, but I don't want to go like that. And well, it's because you don't actually believe you'll be raised like Christ either. And they say, well, what made him think he would be raised like him? I said, well, yeah, it's, he was the first, so it's much scarier for the first, but we can point to him. And then we're back to the resurrection, where you say, well, do I really believe that? If I allow myself to be poured out, and I talk to anyone in a bad relationship, that there's, you know, not all bad relationships should be stayed in. I'm not about to say that. But talk to someone who is suffering in a bad relationship and is called to continue to love. Now, love is not a doormat. Love is not always yes. Love has plenty of no in it. But that's the good parent lays down their life for the child in a serious way. And that's what relationships are about. And that's why I think Christianity is true. Because this is actually the only way the world works.
One other quick thing that I was thinking of when you said this, I have to quote this because I quote it every time, but Lewis, one of my Lewis quotes is, what you see and hear depends a lot upon where you're standing. It also depends upon the kind of person you are. That is a fundamental tenet of I would say how the Orthodox view things, is that the holy will see God. If you think that you can believe and see God and understand it rightly and believe in the resurrection without entering into the way of Christ and holiness, you can't. You won't see it until, as you approach holiness, God will make more and more sense.
Which is one of those statements, like the kinds of thing Calvinists say, that really tick everybody off because it's an inside trick. Well, we have just a few more minutes and we should wrap this up. So
let's talk about Christology.
let's talk about when someone can call themselves a Christian. We can do that in 8 minutes.
Oh yeah. I don't know. We can also round it up. I mean, it's 10-3, guys. Seriously.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Job.
I could sleep for those 8 more minutes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Job, for staying.
I really enjoyed talking to you all. Likewise. Yeah. I'm okay with publishing.
Oh, that is a question.
So, I mean,
yeah, I'm good with it.
You've got the most to lose, probably.
Who?
You.
Me? How? Nobody knows who I am. So, I'm good. So, only my soul. No.
You don't believe you have one anyway.
See, no, I have to go to sleep. But
if you lose it for Christ's sake, you'll find it. So you're fine.
Oh, Luke, with the propaganda, just bringing it down.
Look, at some point, I just there has to be like a basic theology talk where I can just spout all my shitty informed atheist talking points. No, I'm serious, and just have an honest conversation about those. And most of the time I don't want to do that because, yeah, we've heard those all before. But yeah. But that's maybe for another time.
Well, you can't do it in 7 minutes?
No,
I'm kidding. Don't start. No, this has been fun. And if, you know, everyone agrees, I'll post it. I should probably post it after I do my talk with Luke. I also had a talk with Mary today, and that talk with Nathan Jacobs, I cannot believe that happened. I never lost a conversation before. And why that one? So good.
Sacrifice mine, delete mine, and post his.
What if I could? I can't. God. It's as if I never recorded it. I don't know how that happened. I know I hit the button. I checked this. This is recording, so it should be all good. But anyway. So.
Well, I give my thumbs up for posting too, even though I'm risking putting my heresy out there into the foreverness of the internet.
Or Lewis's. This is already out there.
If we've spoken truthful, this should be nothing to worry about.
You get into lots of trouble for speaking the truth. You often get into bigger trouble for speaking the truth than lying.
I know where you're going. I know where you're going with that. So
only the best kind, Joe. The best kind of trouble.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. We will bid Job a good night and a thank you to the rest of you for dreaming up this crazy idea. And I guess if others want to have group conversations, they should probably sort of do likewise. Arrange some people who will agree to be on with you and let me know. And, you know, we'll try some others. It's a different kind of thing. So we'll have to see how it goes.
Yeah.
Same time next week. Got it.
No, seriously, thanks guys. I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for giving your slot.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
All right.
You guys take care.
All right, all.
Bye. Bye-bye.